Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The story shocked the world. A 7-year-old Russian boy sent back alone to Russia by an American adoptive mother who pinned a note to his shirt saying she could not deal with him. Like sending a cold bowl of soup back to the kitchen in a restaurant. But this was a boy, a child, sent packing. International adoption has been a blessing for untold numbers of families and children. This week, it's under the microscope. This hour, On Point, taking a fresh look at global adoption. A special note, when this show first went to air today, news reports said Russia had suspended all U.S. adoptions. Later reports put that in doubt, but you will hear references to the early news throughout this hour. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the story of the boy sent back alone to Moscow? What's your insight on international adoption? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. A little story out of Tennessee, and it got the world's attention in a hurry. The next day on Good Morning America, ABC's, here was Russian President Medvedev condemning the return of the adopted child.
First of all, it's monstrous on the part of his adoptive parents to take the kid and virtually throw him out over the plane in the opposite direction and to say, "I'm sorry, I could not cope with it. Take everything back. It's not only immoral, but also against the law." And secondly, what is now of my special concern is the fact that the quantity of such cases in America is on the rise.
Today, Russia says it's suspending the adoption of Russian children by American families. American officials all over this. Early in the week, here's U.S. Ambassador to Russia, John Byerly, telling the CBS Early Show on Tuesday that the U.S. is planning on meetings with Russia to make sure nothing like this case ever happens again.
Our proposal to send a team out here to Moscow has been accepted now by the Russian government in principle, and we're working out the dates, probably next week, when we'll start more formal discussions leading to that kind of agreement.
We're going to look at the big picture in this hour, risks, rewards, and realities of international adoption. But let's go first to the source of this story, nearly. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Blake Farmer. He's a reporter and producer for WPLN Nashville Public Radio. Blake, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
How did this story break? How did you first learn about it? Was it not until this poor boy got to Moscow?
Well, that's when folks here in Tennessee learned. The news really came out of Moscow when he arrived. This family, the Hansons, the mother, Tori Hansen, the grandmother, Nancy, they had not had encounters with the law. The state's Department of Children's Services said it had not had in contact with them. So we knew of nothing until the news came over from Moscow.
And where does this stand today? He's there. She's here. There's been talk of criminal charges. Russia wants that. Is there any chance of that happening?
Well, that's been the question from day one, and you got a lot of talk from adoption experts, even here in the U.S., saying, you know, we'll prosecute to the, you know, fullest extent of the law. However, everyone's saying, well, we don't have charges to press. The State Department is apparently telling the sheriff there in Bedford County, that's Shelbyville, Tennessee, that, well, there's no federal laws broken, so you're going to have to press charges. The folks in Shelbyville, Tennessee are saying, well, maybe the people near Dulles International, where the flight actually left to Moscow, are to press charges, and the prosecutor there says no. So they're looking.
Blake, what can you tell us about the would be or would have been adoptive mother, Tori Hansen, and what can you tell us about the boy?
Well, to say she's laying low is an understatement. That we really have not heard from them. In fact, she won't even talk to law enforcement. The sheriff says through her attorney, she told him she wouldn't talk unless charges were pressed. They're trying to get around that. But reporters have been knocking on doors all over Shelbyville looking for her, nowhere to be found. She's apparently a 33-year-old mother. She's a nurse. The boy is 7, perhaps turning 8 in the next few days. And he was brought over last year, hadn't been here a long time. We know that the adoption agency here in Tennessee was working with them, but did lose contact in the last couple of weeks, but said that they didn't have any real warning signs that they were looking out for.
Her note said, "To whom it may concern," this is pinned to the child's shirt, "this child is mentally unstable. He's violent and has severe psychopathic issues behaviors. I was lied to and misled by the Russian orphanage workers and director regarding his mental stability. After giving my best to this child, I'm sorry to say that for the safety of my family, friends, and myself, I no longer wish to parent this child. As he is a Russian national, I am returning him to your guardianship and would like the adoption disannulled." Children, this is not a proper word, but anyway, annulled, shall we say. I don't even know if that's a word that applies here. What happens next? Is this just up to Washington and Moscow, or does this get down into the narrow details of citizenship? Is the boy a Russian or an American now? He was legally adopted, right?
Well, you've got adoption advocates here, folks with the National Council for Adoptions, who say, who they called Justin Hansen, his name's Artem Savalyev, when he hit the U.S., he became a U.S. citizen. That's how the law works, apparently. Now, the citizenship is certainly a question, but as far as pressing charges, it sounds like it's going to happen at the state or local level. You have to feel a little bit sorry for the sheriff of Bedford County who's thrown into this. He's asked for the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations to come in and help, but really he's left with a pretty tall order jumping into this diplomatic dispute in a lot of ways.
And now all adoptions by Americans of Russian children frozen, at least for the moment. Blake Farmer at WPOLN Nashville Public Radio. Blake, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Joining me now from Syracuse, New York, is Michelle Goodwin. She's a professor of law at the University of Minnesota, appointments at the Medical School and School of Public Health. She's editor of the new book, Baby Markets, Money, and the New Politics of Creating Families. Michelle Goodwin, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Also with us in our studio is Elizabeth Barthollet. She is professor of law and director of the Child Advocacy Center at Harvard University, author of Nobody's Children. Her article, International Adoption, the Human Rights Position, appears in the current issue of the journal Global Policy. Elizabeth Barthollet, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Michelle, first to you. You know a lot about this realm. What do you make of this story? What's happened here?
Well, Tom, it's a story that's a bit more complicated than what we first thought last week. There have been a number of allegations about the mental health of the Hansons and the possibility that they had treated this child in violent ways. At least that's what's coming from Russia.
You mean of the adoptive mother, not the child you're talking
about? Not of the child, but mm-hmm. of the mother. Because, in fact, it seems, in fact, the actions, the style of what she did, in fact, seems so incredibly egregious. But
let's be careful here. What's the source of that suspicion or allegation? Is there a credible source?
The young man, the little boy, has said that she pulled on his hair and she was not very nice to him. At least this is what's being filtered back from Russia. But I want to put that aside for just one moment, and it's something important that we should address because Russian officials have also taken note and have been quite expressive about the number of Russian children who have died in American custody even this year. And I'd love for us to talk a little bit about that.
What is that number? Do you know it?
Well, it's estimated to be between 15 and 19 Russian children who have died in American custody within the last 10 to 15 years. And even within the last 4 years, we have the case of, in 2006, Peggy Sue Hilt of Manassas, Virginia, was sentenced to 25 years in prison after being convicted of fatally beating her 2-year-old girl who was adopted from Siberia.
That's 15 to 19 maybe, but that's out of, what, something like 60,000 Russian children adopted in this country since, what, 1991?
Sure, but Tom, imagine if that had been black children who had died in the custody of white Americans, that number. We would forget that it happened to have been over 15 years. We'd say that's outrageous.
The details, but what's your big point there, that American families are unfit, that Russian children have a problem, or something else entirely?
Here's my point, Tom, that I'd like to get to, and that is that this is a much more complicated space, transnational adoptions, and that in that space you have many vulnerable players. And so you have a mother and her mother that want to bring a child into their lives. Mm-hmm. And there's a level of vulnerability there. And there's also a level of vulnerability on the part of the child.
Massive.
Too. And there are Americans who, in fact, now understand that they can go abroad and obtain the kids that they want for the right price. And many of them may not be prepared for some of the challenges that they face. So that when I talk about the children who've been harmed in American custody, I'm not making the case that we just have rogue Americans that are looking to bring kids in from other countries and cause them harm. But rather, what we need to look at is what caused these people to behave in the way that they did. These were people who passed home inspections, who had been visited. Russia has put into place some of the most strict protocols for adoption. So what is it in terms of the relationship and the conduct of the children, and then what kinds of resources do the parents have at their disposal to handle some of these issues? And not every state has resources that are specific to children who are adopted from Russia and the former Soviet bloc countries. Mm. In Illinois, they do, and this has actually been helpful for some parents there. In a recent report, in fact, coming out of Chicago, there were a number of parents just this past week that have talked about having some of these same challenges that the Hansons talked about.
Michelle Goodwin, if you'd stand by right there, we have to take a short break here. Elizabeth Bartlett, we'll get to you right after a break here. Thanks to both of you for being with us. The State Department says that Russia, with nearly 1,600 adoptions, down from a high of nearly 6,000 in 2004, was the third most popular adoption country for Americans in 2009, behind China and Ethiopia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about international adoption, its risks, rewards, and realities. 1 week after a 7-year-old Russian boy was rejected and sent back alone by his adoptive American mother. I'm joined today from Michelle Goodwin, the University of Minnesota, editor of Baby Markets, Money and the New Politics of Creating Families. Also with me in the studio today, Elizabeth Bartlett, professor of law, director of the Child Advocacy Center at Harvard University. Her new article in Global Policy is International Adoption, the Human Rights Position. She's a mother of three children, two adopted from Peru as babies. Elizabeth, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. And I want to talk a minute about what I see as the truly tragic story here, mm-hmm. which is represented by that figure you threw out. Adoptions from Russia have dropped from 6,000 to 1,600. Mm-hmm. They're about to go to zero, at least temporarily, and we don't know how long that will last. Adoptions worldwide, mm-hmm. internationally, have dropped from over 40,000 to half that figure since 2004.
Adoptions to the United States or by Americans?
Throughout the world. Throughout the world, international adoptions have dropped from over 40,000 to less than half that. And in the United States, they've dropped from over 20,000 to about half of that.
Why? What's going on?
What's going on is what's going on today in reaction to that, to this story about the Russian abuse. So a bad thing happens, and mm-hmm. I think it was a bad thing this child was put on the plane to Russia. But it is not, you know, in scope, it does not begin to compare to the systematic abuse that occurs to children in institutions. The real world alternative to
institutions
children
abroad, you're
in
saying,
orphanages, institutions throughout the world. The real mm-hmm. world alternative for children who do not get adopted internationally mm-hmm. is to live and often die in institutions. And when they live in institutions, their life prospects are radically damaged and limited.
So you are looking at this as a human rights issue for children. They need adoption.
They need adoption. Adoption is the best alternative for children living and dying now in these institutions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course we should focus on individual instances of abuse. And when we focus on instances, the dozen or maybe as many mm-hmm. as 19 documented mm-hmm. incidents of abuse from Russia.
Death that Michelle was
including
saying.
Some deaths. Mm-hmm. You've got to compare that to the thousands of kids who die in institutions. And you've got to look really at the overall rate of abuse and neglect of adopted children. It is lower than the rate of abuse and neglect of that occurs in normal biological families
lower.
In this country. Mm-hmm. It is lower. Adoption, whether domestic or international, is an extraordinarily safe place for children. And, you know, our reaction, policymakers' reaction to adoption abuses is, I think, both deeply irrational and truly cruel to children, which is what they claim to care about. That if you think about it in terms of abuse and neglect of biological children in the United States, mm-hmm. when an instance of abuse occurs, we don't say, well, let's stop biological parenting. Let's tell those parents in the hospital they can't take their babies home because mm-hmm. we're going to put these kids in institutions mm-hmm. to protect them from abuse and neglect. And yet that is exactly the policy reaction in the international adoption world.
You're taking a child-centered view of this, and that is entirely understandable. And you're looking at it as a human rights question there, as a kind of rescue question there. Michelle Goodwin, what about from a family perspective? Because once the adoption takes place, there's a family, and the family has to work as well. What's going on there? How do you interpret the troubles that are there? And what about Elizabeth's point that, you know, these are relatively modest numbers if you hold it up against the general population?
Well, I think what we'd want to do is to unpack that a little bit further. So what we'd want to do is disaggregate and to take the component of children who are adopted from Russia and see how we would compare that to the overall number of children who were adopted, because it is striking and alarming. This was not the first the case of Justin was not the first case this year involving controversy with a child who was adopted from Russia. Just earlier this year, prosecutors in Pennsylvania met with Russian diplomats in regard to a 7-year-old adopted child being killed. So this is not the first time this year that Russian officials have put the spotlight on the United States. And in fact, just earlier in the week, in Minnesota, in Hastings, Minnesota, before Justin was put on the plane, there was Joey Jarvis, a 14-year-old who went to school threatening to kill his teachers and fellow students. He, too, had been returned by his adoptive American parents, only he was surrendered to the state. His parents tried, and after spending tens of thousands of dollars, found that they really could not help him in the way in which they thought that they could.
What's the root problem here, Michelle?
One of the root problems happens to be with Russian adoptions that some of these children are exposed to alcohol in utero. So there's fetal alcohol syndrome, which might distinguish the cases of children who are being adopted from Russia than from perhaps other countries where we see a lower incidence of that. It also raises another issue, too, as to why Americans are choosing to go abroad in such incredible numbers and to spend so much to adopt from abroad when there are so many children who are available for adoption here in the United States.
What do you mean by spend so much?
Oh, well, it can cost up to $30,000 to finance adopting a child who comes from abroad.
Is there a shortage of children in the United States that need adoption?
Well, of course, certainly there isn't. You know, we have what Richard Posnas and Elizabeth Landis called a glut of children for adoption in the United States. They happen to be overwhelmingly of color, black and Latino, but there are a significant number of children who are available in the United States. In fact, in some states, it can be as little as 1 month to get a child and cost as little as $2,000 to $4,000, if anything at all, to bring a black child in the United States home.
Elizabeth Bartlett, how do you see the demand for Americans for children from overseas, if that's the right way to put it? You clearly see it as a mission of mercy for these children, but is there some imbalance here, or is this just sort of natural balance of the world? People look for adoptions here, they look for adoptions there.
I wouldn't call it a mission of mercy. For most of us adoptive parents, it's a supremely selfish act that we choose to adopt, and we get enormous pleasure out of it. It just happens to be a selfish act that I do think actually serves children's best interests.
But why? Is
there a need to go abroad? We make adoption too difficult. We make adoption too difficult in this country. We make adoption too difficult abroad. We should reduce the barriers to adoption. We should be opening the doors to prospective parents saying, you know, come in, we welcome you. And from my point of view, I'm happy to have them adopt domestically or internationally. I think the it would be wrong to push them away saying, we think preferably that you should adopt here, mm-hmm. not abroad. First of all, I think all children deserve homes, and that actually the children in institutions abroad are typically even worse off than children in foster care in this country. But even more important, I think the more you say to prospective parents, we're going to reduce barriers, come in, we welcome you, and here are various opportunities, the more you will encourage them to adopt both domestically and abroad.
I have to say, I know such beautiful families formed by adoptions of American children here and also children from abroad who have come here. We've got web comments here. Corey says, I've never understood the need to adopt children from abroad other than the cachet of a cute little foreign baby. Okay, he says, let's not outsource jobs or adoptions. Well, there's a perspective. But here's Anne. She says, we know several families with international adopted children from Ethiopia, Korea, Guatemala, Russia, Vietnam, China. That's several. All of these kids, she says, are healthy and well-adapted in loving families. She said, I think the quality of the adoption agency and the prenatal and early care the children receive are the critical factors to having successful adoptions. We'll look at those. Elizabeth?
And on that point, Amy, absolutely that is critical. And part of the problem with adoption now and the barriers I talk about is not only does it push prospective parents away from kids who need homes, but the negative adoption policies we have mean that kids, even if they're lucky enough eventually to get adopted, spend months and years in institutions. Those months and years damage those kids that many of them in ways that many of them will never recover from, and in ways that, of course, make it difficult for them to adjust in adoptive families. So 6 decades of research tells us that if you get kids out of institutions mm-hmm. as early as possible and put them in adoptive homes, that is what will determine how well they do.
But, of course, it doesn't always happen, and people then have to work through the realities of that. Let's hear from our listeners. Burlington, Massachusetts. Amy, you're on the air, Amy.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a member of a family that adopted an older child. She became my youngest sister.
Uh-huh.
The first point I do want to make is that I want to make it absolutely clear that I don't excuse the behavior of this mom.
In Tennessee, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think what she did was inexcusable. And my question as I'm listening to these stories is, did she seek support from the appropriate sources? However, it's very complicated. My family was completely unprepared for the challenges and stresses of incorporating an older child who had been abandoned and abused into this family. And I can't even imagine the stress level on a single mother. My parents were a great team, and they wanted this more than anything, and they did absolutely everything they could until this child eventually estranged herself from the family when she was about 17, after wreaking much havoc. And frankly, this relates back to the point of transparency that you keep bringing up.
Hmm.
We went with a very, my parents went with a very reputable adoption agency in Massachusetts, and they basically washed their hands of my parents. They said, well, you know, you should talk to your pediatrician. They had nothing to offer them, nothing. There are a lot of pressures at work here. There's agencies that want to make money. There are governments that want to make money. This is a business. And frankly, as my parents were struggling to try to figure out the best thing to do to support this child, the response from the agency was minimal.
Well, you're on your own, more or less. Amy, thank you for that story. I'll raise it with my guests. We got so many callers. Let me get another, and then we'll pick it up. Alita in Normal, Illinois. Alita, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am an adoptive parent, not from Russia. My child is from China.
Okay.
And I just had 2 comments, and I can take them off the air, but the prospective adoptive parents, like myself and my husband, we went through extensive orientation and training, and our adoption agency, we felt, was very reputable.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the training alerts parents that children can come with a personal history and background that may be very traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
They're definitely not to be considered a commodity that can just be returned. And parents are also educated how to handle stress, the stress of becoming a new parent suddenly, and, you know, the particulars of international adoption. And
did you feel well supported, Alita, in the process in your case?
Yes, and part of the training emphasizes that, you know, we should identify the potential specialists we might need to get in touch with after we return home and find out more about the child, because there are always unanticipated things. I mean, even someone who gives birth naturally doesn't know what they're going to get, you know.
Or exactly, you're right. Parenthood is complicated.
That's true. And so we're encouraged to kind of identify ahead of time what kind of professionals we might need to seek help from in the community, and also have our support system of, you know, family and friends lined up.
Yeah, everybody needs that. Alita, I appreciate your call as well. Thank you very much. Okay, there's just two examples, Elizabeth. Let me come to you first. I mean, adoption is not simple, and it can get quite complicated, as our caller Amy points out. I mean, the human life is complicated, and these are stories that are more complicated than usual here, especially when it's international. You've got other factors coming into play. What's an acceptable amount of, you know, extra care to be required, or is it just, you know, if you've got your toe in, you're in. That's it.
Well, I do think agencies need to be supportive and provide some of the kinds of services that were mentioned in those two mm-hmm. calls. But we can't give up on changing the policy. I mean, the reason so many services are needed is because we have seriously anti-child policies that require that children sit in institutions and get damaged. So they
Whose
will
policies?
Then need
American, or do you mean Russian
mostly,
and everything else?
There are other countries' policies, but American policy often goes along with it because, you know, who's going to fight for the rights of kids who are sitting in institutions? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you compare, for example, my children in Peru were mm-hmm. put into my arms at age 1 month and 4 months. Mm-hmm. Those are ages when children can thrive.
So adaptive, absolutely.
That is what ought mm-hmm. to happen worldwide. It is now unheard
of. But older children need homes, too.
It is unheard of mm-hmm. today for children to be placed as infants. Now, mm. that is the crime that we should be focusing on. Yep. People should be going to prison for that. And, you know, because it is a crime to hold children, and yet it is being deliberately done. Russia, for example, instituted years ago now a policy of systematically holding all children before they can be considered for international adoption for 6 months while they look for in-country adoptive homes, mm-hmm. whether or not those homes exist, which for the most part they don't. Mm. So characteristically throughout the world for 10-15 years now, policies of other countries have been getting more negative, more restrictive, driven, and this is part of my human rights point, mm-hmm. by some of the organizations that call themselves child human rights organizations like UNICEF.
We'll look at that. Michelle, how much transparency yes. is out there when it comes to these adoptions, and what parents should know and do know?
Here's the important part, which is that, one, there are language barriers. Secondly, there are cultural barriers. And so this can be very difficult for families to overcome. You also mentioned resources. For the parents who've spent all of their savings to adopt a child, there may be very limited resources left over for therapy to help the family come together. And so Americans do need to be better prepared. But in this system where Americans are willing to pay more to travel abroad and to adopt a child, this incentivizes organizations that are quite altruistic and care about children, but it also incentivizes the bad players too, those who would look to obtain children by whatever means in order to provide them to Americans. And so we have cases of children being kidnapped, stolen from their parents, agencies lying to Americans about the ages of their children. Professor David Smolin has spoken about this in his own personal experience, adopting two daughters who, in fact, had been stolen from their mothers and then had been lied to about their ages. We've also seen these similar cases in Minnesota. Guatemala issued a moratorium for 2 years. So this is important.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about international adoption, its risks, rewards, and realities. 1 week after that 7-year-old Russian boy was rejected and sent back alone by his adoptive American mother. And Elizabeth Bartlett is with us. She's a director of the Child Advocacy Center at Harvard University. Michelle Goodwin is with us. She is professor of law at the University of Minnesota and editor of Baby Markets. Let's get a couple of calls here. Lexington, Kentucky. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to address some things that I've heard, you know, from some of your panel.
Yes, please.
And there are some things that I've heard. Many people, we even had this from friends. Why go overseas? Why parents go overseas? Well, we looked here in America first. And because it's very difficult with the Interstate Compact, it has nothing to do with race, but many of these adoptions that they're wanting that are available.
Yep.
They're open adoptions. That's what they're encouraging. And you can't adopt and make it final for close to 22 months. So we could not in good conscience tell our biological children, hey, let these two children join our family, hang out for a couple of years. They may or may not be your brother and sister.
Oh, I see. That's, right. That's hard. That's hard.
And so we went overseas and adopted from Russia. And I can speak from firsthand experience. Russia lies to you. They will lie to you about your children's history. They will lie to you about what they are saying that these children come with and their experiences. I have a very, very close network of friends all over the world. We have talked almost daily for 4 years. They're all over the United States. I even have one expat friend that lives in Russia that just completed an adoption in Russia. We have all horrific stories. Some have turned out well, but we have children who have literally witnessed a parent, a biological parent, murdering another parent. It is not mentioned in the paperwork anywhere. There are children that have fetal alcohol syndrome. There are children who have been sexually abused in these orphanages. There are these children many times have reactive attachment disorder. Go search in the United States, and you are hard-pressed to find a qualified therapist to treat a child with reactive attachment disorder. These children do not have a conscience or a conscience development. Therefore, they have no empathy for anyone else, and they do not understand. You can't discipline these children because there's nothing you could take away. You can't take privileges away. You can't take toys away. It doesn't matter because they don't care, because they can't understand. They do not, like I said, they do not have empathy developed.
Jessica, we've got your report, and I appreciate it. It's clearly born of experience and heartfelt and keenly observed there. Thank you for your call. I want to bring in right here, just on that point, clinical psychologist Joseph LaBarbera. He specializes in work with children, adolescents, young adults, has worked with many children adopted from Russia and other countries. He's an associate professor of psychiatry at Vanderbilt University, joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. Joseph LaBarbera, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks very much for having me, Tom.
What have you seen in your experience, and what did it leave you thinking about Tori Hansen and the story the whole country learned about last week?
Well, I thought the Hansen story was skewed in the direction of vilifying the mother. Most of the parents that I've come across in my practice who've gone to the tremendous expense and made the tremendous commitment of adopting a child from another country, including Russia, are fundamentally good parents. And the idea that her behavior, although this woman is from Tennessee, I have no direct knowledge of this particular individual, that her behavior is reflective of a significant problem in terms of the American parents of Russian children. It seems to me that's not necessarily an appropriate assumption.
I think you just heard our caller, Jessica, saying Russia lies to you, and then with her litany of troubles there. What do you make of that? How common, how uncommon?
Well, I hear from parents not so much lying as much as a lack of information. Lack of information in the sense of parents who have not been permitted to actually observe the orphanages themselves. Sometimes they have been, but a lot of times they haven't. Coming back to this country with a child who has no records despite being sometimes several years old. The problem then becomes one of the child's problems becoming more evident as the child gets older and stronger and more capable of communicating problems that the parent's not able to as effectively handle as when the child was younger.
You're going to see these children when there are real problems, but how common is that?
Well, I'm obviously seeing a subset of children.
Right, that's what I mean.
And my my guess is that there are many kids who end up being adopted from Russia and other countries who do quite well and who grow up to be successful teenagers and adults and U.S. citizens.
I'm reading here, this is from Lisa Belkin's Motherlode column in the New York Times, and she's got a Judith writing in talking about how she'd had adoption issues with her Russian child, and she says, you know, fast forward to today, we're a family, he's 9 3/4, happy, healthy, funny, handsome, and amazing soccer player, adored by family and friends. So it's not like it's all disaster by any means out
no,
there.
No, it's not all doom and gloom. On the other hand, we should be concerned about that subset of kids who don't make it for reasons that we can put our finger on, namely the early conditions in Russia that in all likelihood end up damaging these kids, sometimes for an extended period of time, if not indefinitely.
Dr. LaBarbera, let me take a call on this front. Kate in Arlington, Massachusetts. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm the parent of a Romanian adoptee. I've been her mother now for almost 15 years. My child is now institutionalized. She hasn't been able to live at home for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And at the time she went into a residential program, the hospital actually would not let her out until she had a residential placement because of her propensity for violence. I adopted her when she had just turned 2. She was the size of a baby. She was developmentally about 5 months old. She couldn't localize sound. She couldn't track visually. She was close to death from malnutrition.
Did you know all this when you adopted her, Kate? Was this all clear to you?
Well, it was clear that something was really wrong. And I knew it when I saw her, and she was a rocker and a headbanger. And so I called the adoption agency in the U.S. and I said, I think this child's autistic. And they had various people in Romania when I was there come and look at her and say, oh no, just typical institutional stuff. It'll go away.
How old is she now, Kate?
She's almost 17. Very, very delayed developmentally. She still has a real propensity for violence. She doesn't have normal relationships with people.
And Kate, if I may, when you look back on this whole experience, and forgive me, but we have a lot of callers, and I'm sorry, but when you look back on the whole experience, do you say to yourself, well, you know, anybody who signs up for parenthood, natural, adopted, you name it, there are unknowns, and so, you know, this is the reality I was dealt, or do you look at it some other way now?
Well, you know, she's a person. She deserves a life. She deserves a family. You know, in the process, she really destroyed my life. And you know, I'm hardly exceptional in this regard. The thing that I wanted to mention that I hadn't heard your speakers talk to was that there are neurological changes which happen as a result of lack of stimulation. Dr. Sharon Cermak at BU has done a lot of work on this mm-hmm. with the Romanian kids. For every 3 months of lack of stimulation, there are detectable changes in the brain that are really irreversible because the kids miss milestones when the neural pathways hook up, so you wind up having kids who are not going to be whose problems are not going to be remedied by love and chicken soup and psychotherapy. They're neurologically damaged as a result of their experience.
Kate, let us pick it up right there, if we may. And I thank you for your call and sharing that. Dr. LaBarbera, what do you make of Kate's story? And is it widely applicable, or is it again at the fringes?
Well, it's a particularly sad and unfortunate case, obviously, but I think the caller made several points, one of which is that there are several fairly specific consequences that we often see, and those include developmental delay, inability to do things that other kids that same age would be expected to be able to do, number one. Number two, a lack of self-control. Number three, difficulty in relating to other kids. And it is true that a lack of stimulation and a lack of contact and interaction with a loving caregiver during the early months of life does have consequences, particularly with respect to that latter area having to do with ability to relate and bond and attach to a loving parent.
My guest, Elizabeth Bartlett, says it's practically a crime not to be sure children have that at those early weeks and months of life. But if they don't, can and should these children, what should happen around transparency? Can adoptive parents know what they're getting into? Is it possible to know?
I don't think they can know at this point. I'm hopeful that the delegation of U.S. representatives who are meeting with their Russian counterparts will bring up these matters and emphasize that we may conceivably have issues on this end, but there are issues on your end that need to be remedied as well. And one would hope that the delegation is not going to be to see this in unilateral terms, namely as simply an American issue, and need to appease the grumpy Russians.
Very interesting. And, of course, an American delegation on its way in the next few days to get into this whole issue. Joseph LaBarbera, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Vanderbilt University, joining us from Nashville. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Elizabeth Bartlett, you're listening and keen to be
in
here.
I think prospective parents need not to be overwhelmingly discouraged by this, because if you look overall at the picture of children even coming out of institutions into international adoption, most of them do all right. So most of them are not going to end up institutionalized here again. I think if your child comes from an institution, you are well advised to go to an expert early, because some of these problems will be much better addressed if they exist early than later, and they may not be that visible early. And then prospective and actual adoptive parents need to fight, because what's happening in Romania for changing policies for the better. Mm-hmm. Romania has now, as with most adoption, turned for the worst, so that kids are no longer being released at all from the horrendous institutions in Romania to international adoption, because international adoption was closed down as a condition for Romania joining the European Union. They were forced to close down international adoption, so those kids are condemned to institutions. And
Michelle Goodwin, you're listening to all this. I wonder what you're thinking.
Well, I'm thinking that this is a complicated issue, and I agree with Elizabeth that we need to think about children who are vulnerable and who need homes. We need to think about that as a human rights issue. And I think that that's a human rights issue that has to also be examined within our own borders. We tend to think about human rights as being associated with the needs of children who are coming from developing countries or those where there's economic plight. But we have this as an issue in our own country. And when we think about how Americans can rally, they can rally in their own communities to help change laws. I think that that's far more convenient for Americans, and I think it should also be a priority for Americans. Now, I would not want that to be heard as being in any way a condemnation against international adoptions, but I do think that Americans go into the process far less prepared than they should be. I think it's also very clear that Americans spend so much on these adoptions when, in fact, they can be facilitated for less, far less, in the United States. But it means that the children that they take home will be from a less exotic location like Milwaukee or Detroit.
Well, that's fine. What about our caller who said, though, in the States, and I don't know if this is national or just in that state, but it would be what did she say, 22 months until she'd know for sure whether this child would be part of her family.
I'm glad that she raised that issue. And, in fact, that was my point, which is that to the extent that we're looking for something to fight for children, then let's, in fact, rally around making sure that children who are in the United States who need homes, that those kinds of placements become far more easy to facilitate. So that is true in some states. It may take longer, but equally, I'm sure you have listeners who would tell you that to adopt a black child in the United States can take less than 4 weeks.
And Elizabeth, at a policy level, at home, abroad, you know, top line, what would you push for?
I totally agree with Michelle. I'd like policies to be easier here. And I would just say that I think policies with respect to international adoption are way worse even than the relatively restrictive policies for domestic adoption here. So we just need to work on all of these fronts.
Do you see hope there? You heard Joseph LaBarbera saying he hopes the American delegation that goes to Russia says, okay, this wasn't good, but let's see what we can do about how you're treating your orphans in Russia.
I do see hope. I think people at least are saying that they care about children when they look at the incident of this child being put on the airplane. If they really care about children, there should be hope, because then they should focus on the larger picture of children who need homes.
And what will happen to this boy? Sent back on the flight to Moscow with a note pinned to his shirt.
He's
in an orphanage.
He may be unusually lucky compared to other orphans in Russia, in the sense that he may get a lot of attention because he's, you know, but of course, it's a terrible situation. He started, as I understand the facts, abused in his biological home in Russia, had no doubt a horrible time, as most children do, in institutions, and now has this incident. So a bad history.
Michelle, what are you anticipating for him?
I'm anticipating that, as Elizabeth said, there will be significant attention around this child, and I think that there will be considerable scrutiny as to whether or not a family will bring him home, given what we know.
Michelle Goodwin has joined us today from Syracuse, New York. She's a professor of law at the University of Minnesota, editor of Baby Markets, Money and the New Politics of Creating Families. Michelle Goodwin, thank you very much for your time and insights today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And Elizabeth Bartlett, author of Nobody's Children, Abuse and Neglect, Foster Drift, and the Adoption Alternative. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for your comments, for your reality checks, your stories, and your time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.